Howell pinched the bridge of his nose and squinted wearily at the wax-spattered paper. The play wasn't going well at all. He'd sorted out the falling chandelier and found a place for a villain who wore a mask to conceal his disfigurement, and he'd rewritten one of the funny bits to allow for the fact that the hero had been born in a handbag. It was the clowns who were giving him trouble again. They kept changing every time he thought about them. He preferred them in twos, that was traditional, but now there seemed to be a third one, and he was blowed if he could think of any funny lines for him. His quill moved scratchily over the latest sheet of paper, trying to catch the voices that had streamed through his dreaming mind and had seemed so funny at the time. His tongue began to stick out of the corner of his mouth. He was sweating. "This is my little study," he wrote. "Hey, with a little study, you could go a long way. And I wish you'd start now. If you can't leave in a cab, then leave in a huff. If that's too soon, then leave in a minute and a half. Say, you got a pencil? A crayon?" Howell stared at this in horror. On the page it looked nonsensical, ridiculous, and yet, in the thronged auditorium of his mind, he dipped the quill in the inkpot and chased the echoes further. "Second clown. That's a right boss. Third clown. Business with bladder on stick. Honk, honk." Howell gave up. Yes, it was funny. He knew it was funny. He'd heard the laughter in his dreams, but it wasn't right. Not yet. Maybe never. It was like the other idea he had about two clowns, one fat, one thin.
"This is a mean, dainty mess you've gotten me into, Stanley."
He had laughed until his chest ached, and the rest of the company had looked at him in astonishment, but in his dreams it was hilarious. He laid down the pen and rubbed his eyes. It must be nearly midnight. And the habit of a lifetime told him to spare the candles, although, for a fact, they could afford all the candles they could eat now, whatever Vitola might say. Hour gongs were being struck all across the city, and night watchmen were proclaiming that it was indeed midnight, and also that, in the face of all the evidence, all was well. Many of them got as far as the end of the sentence before being mugged. Howell pushed open the shutters and looked out at Ankh Morpork. It would be tempting to say the Twin City was at its best this time of year, but that wouldn't be entirely correct. It was at its most typical. The River Ankh, the cloaca of half a continent, was already pretty wide and silt-laden when it reached the city's outskirts. By the time it left, it didn't so much flow as exude. Owing to the accretion of the mud of centuries, the bed of the river was in fact higher than some of the low-lying areas, and now, with the snow melt swelling the flow, many of the low-rent districts of the Morpork side were flooded. If you can use that word for a liquid you could pick up in a net. This sort of thing happened every year, and would have caused havoc with the drains and the sewage systems. So it is just as well that the city didn't have very many. Its inhabitants merely kept a punt handy in the backyard, and periodically built another story on the house. It was reckoned to be very healthy there. Very few germs were able to survive. Howell looked across a sort of misty sea in which buildings clustered like a sandcastle competition at high tide. Flares and lighted windows made pleasing patterns on the iridescent surface. But there was one glare of light, much closer to hand, which particularly occupied his attention. On a patch of slightly higher ground by the river, bought by Vitola for a ruinous sum, a new building was rising. It was growing even by night, like a mushroom. Howell could see the cressets burning all along the scaffolding as the hired craftsmen, and even some of the players themselves, refused to let the mere shade of the sky interrupt their labours. New buildings were rare in Morpork, but this was even a new type of building. The disc. Vitola had been aghast at the idea at first, but young Tom John had kept at him, and everyone knew that once the lad had got the feel of it, he could persuade water to flow uphill.
"But we've always moved around, laddie,"
said Vitola, in the desperate voice of one who knows that, at the end of it all, he's going to lose the argument. "I can't go around settling down at my time of life." "It's not doing you any good," said Tom John firmly. "All these cold nights and frosty mornings, you're not getting any younger. We should stay put somewhere and let people come to us. And they will, too. You know the crowds we're getting now? Howell's plays are famous."
"It's not my plays," Howell had said. "It's the players."
"I can't see me sitting by a fire in a stuffy room and sleeping on feather beds and all that nonsense," said Vitola. But he'd seen the look on his wife's face and had given in. And then there had been the theatre itself. Making water run uphill was a parlour trick compared to getting cash out of Vitola, but it was a fact that they had been doing well these days. Ever since Tom John had been big enough to wear a ruff and say two words without his voice cracking. Howell and Vitola had watched the first few beams of the wooden framework go up.
"It's against nature,"
Vitola had complained, leaning on his stick.
"Capturing the spirit of the theatre, putting it in a cage, it'll kill it."
"Oh, I don't know,"
said Howell diffidently. Tom John had laid his plans well. He'd devoted an entire evening to Howell before even broaching the subject to his father, and now the dwarf's mind was on fire with the possibilities of backdrops and scenery changes and wings and flies and magnificent engines that could lower gods from the heavens and trapdoors that could raise demons from hell. Howell was no more capable of objecting to the new theatre than a monkey was of resenting a banana plantation.
"Damn thing hasn't even got a name," Vitola had said. "I should call it the gold mine, because that's what it's costing me. Where's the money going to come from? That's what I'd like to know."
In fact, they'd tried a lot of names, none of which suited Tom John. "It's got to be a name that means everything," he said, "because there's everything inside it. The whole world on a stage, do you see?" And Howell had said, knowing as he said it, that what he was saying was exactly right.
"The disc."
And now the disc was nearly done, and still he hadn't written the new play. He shut the window and wandered back to his desk, picked up the quill, and pulled another sheet of paper towards him. A thought struck him. The whole world was a stage, to the gods. Presently he began to write.
"All the disc, it is but a theatre," he wrote, "and all men and women are but players."
He made the mistake of pausing, and another inspiration sleeted down, sending his train of thought off along an entirely new track. He looked at what he'd written and added,
"Except those who sell popcorn."
After a while he crossed this out and tried,
"Like unto the stage of a theatre is the world, whereon all persons strut as players."
This seemed a bit better. He thought for a bit and continued conscientiously,
"Sometimes they walk on, sometimes they walk off."
He seemed to be losing it. Time, time. What he needed was an infinity. There was a muffled cry and a thump from the next room. Howell dropped the quill and pushed open the door cautiously. The boy was sitting up in bed, white-faced. He relaxed when Howell came in.
"Howell?" "What's up, lad? Nightmares?"
"God, it was terrible. I saw them again. I really thought for a minute that..." Howell, who was absent-mindedly picking up the clothes that Tom John had strewn around the room, paused in his work. He was keen on dreams. That was when the ideas came.
"That what?"
he said. "It was like... I mean... I was sort of inside something, like a bowl, and there were these three terrible faces peering in at me.
I?
Yes. And then they all said, all hail. And then they started arguing about my name. And then they said, anyway, who shall be king hereafter? And then one of them said, hereafter what? And one of the other two said, just hereafter, girl. That's what you're supposed to say in these circumstances. You might try and make an effort. And then they all peered closer, and one of the others said, he looks a bit peaky. I reckon it's all that foreign food. And then the youngest one said, Nanny, I've told you already there's no such place as Thespia. And then they bickered a bit, and one of the old ones said, he can't hear us, can he? He's tossing and turning a bit. And the other one said, you know, I've never been able to get sound on this thing, Esme. And then they bickered some more, and it went cloudy, and then I woke up, he finished lamely. It was horrible, because every time they came close to the bowl, it sort of magnified everything, so all you could see was eyes and nostrils.
Howell hoisted himself onto the edge of the narrow bed.
Funny old things, dreams, he said.
Not much funny about that one.
No, but I mean, last night I had this dream about a little bandy-legged man walking down a road, said Howell. He had a little black hat on, and he walked as though his boots were full of water.
Tom John nodded politely. Yes, he said. And?
Well, that was it. And nothing. He had this little cane which he twirled, and, you know, it was incredibly...
Dwarf's voice trailed off. Tom John's face had that familiar expression of polite and slightly condescending puzzlement that Howell had come to know and dread.
Anyway, it was very amusing, he said, half to himself.
But he knew he'd never convince the rest of the company. If it didn't have a custard pie in it somewhere, they said it wasn't funny. Tom John swung his legs out of bed and reached for his breeches.
I'm not going back to sleep, he said. What's the time?
It's after midnight, said Howell. And you know what your father said about going to bed late?
I'm not, said Tom John, pulling on his boots. I'm getting up early. Getting up early is very healthy, and now I'm going out for a very healthy drink. You can come too, he added, to keep an eye on me.
Howell gave him a doubting look.
You also know what your father said about going out drinking, he said.
Yes, he said he used to do it all the time when he was a lad. He said he'd think nothing of quaffing ale all night and coming home at 5 a.m. smashing windows. He said he was a bit of a royster doister, not like these white-livered people today who can't hold their drink.
Tom John adjusted his doublet in front of the mirror and added, you know, Howell, I reckon responsible behaviour is something you get when you grow older, like varicose veins.
Howell sighed. Tom John's memory for ill-judged remarks was legendary.
All right, he said. Just the one, though. Somewhere decent.
I promise.
Tom John adjusted his hat. It had a feather in it.
By the way, he said, exactly how does one quaff?
I think it means you spill most of it, said Howell.
If the water of the River Ankh was rather thicker and more full of personality than ordinary river water, so the air in the mended drum was more crowded than normal air. It was like dry fog. Tom John and Howell watched it spilling out into the street. The door burst open, and a man came through backwards, not actually touching the ground until he hit the wall on the opposite side of the street. An enormous troll, employed by the owners to keep a measure of order in the place, came out dragging two more limp bodies which he deposited on the cobbles, kicking them once or twice in soft places.
"I reckon they're roistering in there, don't you?" said Tom John.
"It looks like that," said Howell.
He shivered. He hated taverns. People always put their drinks down on his head. They scurried in quickly while the troll was holding one unconscious drinker up by one leg and banging his head on the cobbles in search for concealed valuables. Drinking in the drum has been likened to diving in a swamp.
except that in a swamp, the alligators don't pick your pockets first. 200 eyes watched the pair as they pushed their way through the crowd to the bar. 100 mouths paused in the act of drinking, cursing or pleading, and 99 brows crinkled with the effort of working out whether the newcomers fell into category A, people to be frightened of, or B, people to frighten. Tom John walked through the crowd as though it was his property, and with the impetuosity of youth rapped on the bar. Impetuosity was not a survival trait in the mended drum.
2 pints of your finest ale, landlord, he said,
in tones so carefully judged that the barman was astonished to find himself obediently filling the first mug before the echoes had died away. Howell looked up. There was an extremely big man on his right, wearing the outside of several large bulls and more chains than necessary to moor a warship. A face that looked like a building site with hair on it glared down at him.
"Bloody hell," he said. "It's a bloody loan ornament."
Howell went cold. Cosmopolitan as they were, the people of Moorpork had a breezy, no-nonsense approach to the non-human races, i.e. hit them over the head with a brick and throw them in the river. This did not apply to trolls, naturally, because it's very difficult to be racially prejudiced against creatures 7 feet tall who can bite through walls, at least for very long. But people 3 feet high were absolutely designed to be discriminated against. The giant prodded Howell on the top of his head.
"Where's your fishing rod, lone ornament?" he said.
The barman pushed the mugs across the puddled counter.
"Here you are," he said, leering. "One pint and 1 half pint.
Tom John opened his mouth to speak, but Howell nudged him sharply in the knee. "Put up with it, put up with it. Slip out as soon as possible. It was the only way."
"Where's your little pointy hat, then?" said the bearded man.
The room had gone quiet. This looked like being cabaret time.
"I said, where's your pointy hat, dopey?"
The barman got a grip of the blackthorn stick with nails in it, which lived under the counter just in case, and said,
"I was talking to the lawn ornament here."
The man took the dregs of his own drink and poured them carefully over the silent dwarf's head.
"I ain't drinking here again," he muttered.
When even this failed to have any effect,
"It's bad enough they let monkeys drink here, but pygmies..."
Now the silence in the bar took on a whole new intensity in which the sound of a stool being slowly pushed back was like the creak of doom. All eyes swiveled to the other end of the room, where sat the one drinker in the mended drum who came into category C. What Tom John had thought was an old sack hunched over the bar was extending arms and other arms, except they were its legs. A sad, rubbery face turned towards the speaker, its expression as melancholy as the mists of evolution, its funny lips curled back. There was absolutely nothing funny about its teeth. Said the barman again, his voice frightening even him in that terrible simian silence.
"I don't think you meant that, did you? Not about monkeys, eh? You didn't really, did you?"
"What the hell is that?" hissed Tom John.
"I think it's an orangutan," said Howell. "An ape." "A monkey is a monkey," said the bearded man,
at which several of the drum's more percipient customers started to edge for the door.
"I mean, so what? But these bloody lawn ornaments..."
Howell's fist struck out at groin height. Dwarfs have a reputation as fearsome fighters, Any race of 3-foot-tall people who favour axes and go into battle as into a championship tree-felling competition soon get talked about. But years of wielding a pen instead of a hammer had relieved Howell's punches of some of their stopping power. And it could have been the end of him when the big man yelled and drew his sword if a pair of delicate, leathery hands hadn't instantly jerked the thing from his grip and, with only a small amount of effort, bent it double. An explanation may be needed at this point. The librarian of the Magic Library at Unseen University, the Disc's premier college of wizardry, had been turned into an orangutan some years previously by a magical accident in that accident-prone academy, and since then had strenuously resisted all well-meaning efforts to turn him back. For one thing, longer arms and prehensile toes made getting around the higher shelves a whole lot easier, and being an ape meant that you didn't have to bother with all this angst business. He had also been rather pleased to find that his new body, although looking deceptively like a rubber sack full of water, gave him 3 times the strength and 2x the reach of his old one. When the giant growled and turned round, an arm like a couple of broom handles strung together with elastic and covered with red fur unfolded itself in a complicated motion and smacked him across the jaw so hard that he rose several inches in the air and landed on a table. By the time that the table had slid into another table and overturned a couple of benches, there was enough impetus to start the night's overdue brawl, especially since the big man had a few friends with him. Since no one felt like attacking the ape, who had dreamily pulled a bottle from the shelf and smashed the bottom off the counter, they hit whoever happened to be nearest, on general principles. This is absolutely correct etiquette for a tavern brawl. Howell walked under a table and dragged Tom John, who was watching all this with interest, after him. "So this is Roystron. I always wondered."
"I think perhaps it would be a good idea to leave," said the dwarf firmly, "before there's, you know, any trouble."
There was a thump as someone landed on the table above them, and a tinkle of broken glass.
"Is it real, Roystron, do you suppose, or merely rollicking?" said Tom John, grinning.
"It's going to be bloody murder in a minute, my lad."
Tom John nodded and crawled back out into the fray. Howell heard him thump on the bar counter with something and call for silence. Howell put his arms over his head in panic.
"I didn't mean..." he began.
In fact, calling for silence was a sufficiently rare event in the middle of a tavern brawl that silence was what Tom John got, and silence was what he filled. Howell started as he heard the boy's voice ring out, full of confidence and absolutely first-class projection.
"Brothers, and yet may I call all men brother, for on this night..."
The dwarf craned up to see Tom John standing on a chair, one hand raised in the prescribed declamatory fashion. Around him, men were frozen in the act of giving one another a right seeing to, their faces turned to his. Down at tabletop height, Howell's lips moved in perfect synchronization with the words as Tom John went through the familiar speech. He risked another look. The fighters straightened up, pulled themselves together, adjusted the hang of their tunics, glanced apologetically at one another. Many of them were in fact standing to attention. Even Howell felt a fizz in his blood, and he'd written those words. He'd slaved half a night over them years ago, when Vitola had declared that they needed another 5 minutes in Act 3 of The King of Ankh.
"Scribblers, something with a bit of spirit in it," he'd said. "A bit of zip and sizzle, you know. Something to summon up the blood and put a bit of backbone in our friends in the halfpenny seats. And just long enough to give us time to change the set."
He'd been a bit ashamed of that play at the time. The famous Battle of Morpork, he strongly suspected, had consisted of about 2,000 men lost in a swamp on a cold, wet day, hacking one another into oblivion with rusty swords. What would the last King of Ankh have said to a pack of ragged men who knew they were outnumbered, outflanked, and outgeneraled? Something with bite, something with edge, Something like a drink of brandy to a dying man. No logic, no explanation, just words that would reach right down through a tired man's brain and pull him to his feet by his testicles. Now he was seeing its effect. He began to think the walls had fallen away, and there was a cold mist blowing over the marshes, its choking silence broken only by the impatient cries of the carrion birds. And this voice! And he'd written the words. They were his. No half-crazed king had ever really spoken like this. And he'd written all this to fill in a gap so the castle made of painted sacking stretched over a frame could be shoved behind a curtain. And this voice was taking the coal dusts of his words and filling the room with diamonds. I made these words, Howell thought, but they don't belong to me. They belong to him. Look at those people. Not a patriotic thought among them, but if Tom John asked them, this bunch of drunkards would storm the patrician's palace tonight, and they'd probably succeed. I just hope his mouth never falls into the wrong hands. As the last syllables died away, their white, hot echoes searing across every mind in the room, Howell shook himself and crawled out of hiding and jabbed Tom John on the knee.
"Come away now, you fool," he hissed, "before it wears off."
He grasped the boy firmly by the arm, handed a couple of complimentary tickets to the stunned barman, and hurried up the steps. He didn't stop until they were a street away.
"I thought I was doing rather well in there," said Tom John.
"A good deal too well, I reckon."
The boy rubbed his hands together.
"Right, where shall we go next?"
"Next?
Tonight is young."
"No, tonight is dead. It's today that's young," said the dwarf hurriedly.
"Well, I'm not going home yet. Isn't there somewhere a bit more friendly? We haven't actually drunk anything."
Howell sighed.
"A troll tavern?" said Tom John. "I've heard about them. There's some down in the Shades."
The Shades is an ancient part of Ankh-Morpork, considered considerably more unpleasant and disreputable than the rest of the city. This always amazes visitors.
"I'd like to see a troll tavern."
"They're for trolls only, boy. Molten lava to drink, and rock music, and cheese and chutney-flavoured pebbles."
"What about dwarf bars?"
"You'd hate it,"
said Howell fervently.
"Besides, you'd run out of headroom."
"Low dives, are they?"
"Look at it like this. How long do you think you could sing about gold?"
"It's yellow and it goes chink, and you can buy things with it,"
said Tom John experimentally as they strolled through the crowds on the Plaza of Broken Moons.
"4 seconds, I think."
"Right. 5 hours of it. Gets a bit repetitive."
Howell kicked a pebble gloomily. He'd investigated a few dwarf bars last time they were in town and hadn't approved. For some reason, his fellow expatriates, who at home did nothing more objectionable than mine a bit of iron ore and hunt small creatures, felt impelled, once in the big city, to wear chain-mail underwear, go around with axes in their belts, and call themselves names like Timkin Rumbleguts. And no one could beat a city dwarf when it came to quaffing. Sometimes they missed their mouths altogether.
"Anyway," he added, "you'd get thrown out for being too creative. The actual words are gold, 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 gold."
"Is there a chorus?"
"Gold, gold, 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 gold," said Howell.
"You left out a gold there."
"I think it's because I wasn't cut out to be a dwarf."
"Cut down? Lawn ornament?" said Tom John.
There was a little hiss of indrawn breath.
"Sorry," said Tom John hurriedly. "It's just that Father—"
"I've known your father for a long time," said Howell. "Through thick and thin, and there was a damn sight more thin than thick, since before you were bo—"
He hesitated.
"Times were hard in those days," he mumbled. "So what I'm saying is, well, Some things you earn.
Yes, I'm sorry. You see, just... Howell paused at the mouth of a dark alley.
Did you hear something?
He said.